Welcome to Home in Progress, formerly known as the Repcolite Home Improvement Show. It's going to be the same show, same goals, just a name that kind of better fits what home ownership is really like. I'm your host, Dan Hansen, and around here, we believe that a home isn't a finished product, right? It's a work in progress. Real homes are built one project, one paint can, one weekend at a time, and sometimes, once in a while, that project takes a little longer than we thought. Now, every week, we're going to dive into the real-life side of home improvement, the paint, the flooring, the plumbing, the design choices, all of the stuff that makes your house a better place to be, one step at a time. This week, we're starting off with a conversation about backyard smokers, you know, what they are, why they're addicting, and how to get started. Then we'll be talking about the best paint colors for north-facing rooms. We'll go over some tips for painting outside in the extreme ridiculous heat that we're all dealing with. And then we'll wrap up with a surprisingly satisfying case for hanging your clothes out to dry. Home in Progress is proudly brought to you by Repcolite Paints and Benjamin Moore, offering top-tier paint, expert advice, and the tools to keep your projects moving forward. Let's get started. And the place that I want to start this week is Father's Day a couple of weeks ago. And I want to start there because on Father's Day this year, I received a smoker as a gift. And when I first got it, I was super pumped about it. I guess I still am. But after unboxing it, setting it all up, and then standing there looking at it for a good 15 minutes or more, I realized something important and intimidating. I don't know what I'm doing at all. Completely clueless when it comes to smoking meats. So I figured I would use this opening segment as a public service announcement for anybody else out there who's just starting out with smoking meats, or maybe thinking about getting into this hobby, this money sink that it turns out to be. All right, let's start with the basics. What is a smoker? Well, it's not a grill. It looks kind of like a grill sometimes, but it's not a grill. It's kind of a low and slow oven that cooks food using indirect heat and smoke. You know, that smoke's important. That's a big part of it. It's why it's called a smoker, and it infuses flavor into the meat. And that low temperature that you're cooking at, usually, you know, somewhere right around 200 to 275 degrees, that low temperature gently breaks down tougher cuts of meat. Now, with a smoker, you're not flipping burgers. You know, you're not opening it up and, you know, handling the food a lot and doing a lot of work like that. You're basically gently nurturing, babying pork shoulders, ribs, briskets, sausages, all of whatever you're using over the course of hours, plural. This is not a quick 15 minutes on the grill and you're in the house again. This is hours. It's the long game. And I really didn't understand that entirely until I started researching and I saw people talking about 10-hour cook times like it was no big deal. We shall see. I live a life of rapid decisions, rapid movement. I'm a go, go, go kind of person, and I'm going to see how I do with multiple hour cook times like this. We'll find out. So that's what a smoker is. That's the idea. Now, when you're looking at them, there's a bunch of different types of smokers out there, and depending on what you choose, your experience is going to vary. So I'm going to walk through just some of the main ones. There are electric smokers, and these are basically set it and forget it kind of things. You know, you plug them in, you set the temperature, you add wood chips for smoke, and they hold steady. You know, that's it. Not super flashy, but super easy. There are pellet smokers, and these are higher tech units that burn compressed wood pellets. They look a little bit like grills, and they usually have a digital control. Now, on these, you can smoke, you can roast, you can grill. They're super versatile, and they're a little bit pricier than the other ones. Charcoal smokers, that's another option. This is what I've got. These are more hands-on. You know, you're lighting charcoal, you're managing airflow, you're watching temperatures, all of those things. You get a great smoke flavor, one of the better ones, if not the best one. There's debate out there, but people really like these. But you do need to babysit these more than electric or the pellet units. All right. Offset smokers, another option. These have the firebox on the side and the main cooking chamber to the left or the right. They look classic, and they're the trickiest to master. Basically, you're trying to understand how to manage your fire, your fuel, and your airflow, and that's all crucial to making this work. So they're a little trickier in that regard. Kamado grills. Just think the big green egg things. These are ceramic cookers. They hold heat like a dream. You can grill or you can smoke on them. They're heavy duty, but they do take a little bit of time time, you know, to learn how to maintain that temperature steadily. Just a little bit of a learning curve with those. All right. So those are the smokers, the different types of them. But that's only the beginning. Once you acquire that, you're not done. Now you need tools. And there are a lot of tools that you can acquire as you fall into this rabbit hole that is this hobby. You know, like I said earlier, it's a money sink. I'm not just throwing that word out there. And sometimes money sinks are great. You know, we find hobbies. I fell into guitar, and that's also a money sink. And it's a wonderful money sink. I recommend it to everybody out there. I think this is that same type of thing. So there are a ton of tools that you can buy. And the price ranges are all over the place, but I've compiled a list of tools that every beginner absolutely needs. So this is your go-to, gotta-have list. You know, you can add to it, but these are the must-haves. First thing, a good digital thermometer, because that one that's built into the smoker, everybody online says those are usually way off. So you want a probe that reads the internal temperature of the grill accurately. You're also going to need a thermometer for the internal temperature of the meat. And preferably, you know, you want one that you can leave in while it cooks. There are a lot of wireless ones. They'll actually communicate with your phone, and you can just sit wherever with your beverage and watch your phone and see the temperature of everything you're cooking. You know, you can get some that will report, you know, that have two prongs, and you can record or report the internal temperature of the smoker and the internal temperature of the meat, all back to your phone on the same interface. So a lot of different options out there. Some are crazy pricey, but many are reasonable and they're well reviewed. So dig into all of that, get the recommendations that are out there. Another thing you're gonna need, heat resistant gloves, because surprise, pulling a pork shoulder out of a 250 degree smoker isn't a job for oven mitts. So heat resistant gloves. You're gonna need a spray bottle, you know, a little mister. I'm a little mister. So that's not right. You need a spray bottle. You know, you've got to mist the meat during the cook to keep it from drying out sometimes. Some folks use apple cider vinegar. Others use apple juice or broth, but you definitely need that little spray bottle. Aluminum pans. You're going to use these for water trays, for grease collection. Just resting the meat. You know, it gets tired. No, resting it is a very specific part of the process. I'll talk about it briefly at the end. But you'll use these pans for that, and they'll make cleanup way easier. You're going to need tongs, a grill brush, and foil. You know, these are obvious, but you really can't have too many of them. And people use that foil in the drip trays and stuff like that, again, to make cleanup easier. You're going to need wood pellets or chips, depending on the smoker type. You know, you got to figure out which one of those two you need. Pellets for pellet smokers, chips or chunks for electric and charcoal smokers. But this is where the smoke flavor and all of that comes from. So you'll need those. And of course, if you've got a charcoal smoker, you're going to need a chimney starter and good charcoal. You know, something without additives, preferably. All right. So as I acquire the supplies, the next question that comes into my mind is, what in the world should I cook first? Well, of course, I'm tempted to want to try something like brisket right off the bat. You know, it sounds awesome. But no, the entirety of the internet says don't start with brisket. It's apparently like the souffle of smoking. Instead, there are a wide range of beginner-friendly foods that get recommended instead. So chicken thighs, that's a really good thing to start with. They're cheap, they're forgiving, they're good, they taste great. Sausages or kielbasa. Low effort, high reward. Pork shoulder, you know, it's great for pulled pork. Takes a long time. That's the downside to that one. But it's hard to mess that one up. Smoked mac and cheese. I didn't even know this was a thing, but apparently it's amazing and not terribly difficult. Ribs. These are a little more advanced, but still, they're doable if you follow a plan. Now, I went with chicken thighs, you know, for my first run. I figure low risk, as inexpensive as, you know, it's relatively inexpensive if I mess it up, and a high reward. You know, they're supposed to be really good. So we'll do that. Now, the next question that comes up, and maybe there's, you know, maybe your questions come up in different order. This is how my questions came up. So I figured out what I'm going to cook. I figured out what kind of smoker to get, all of those things. I got all my tools, but what kind of wood do I use to get the smoky flavor? Because there's all kinds of different woods. I started to talk about that a little bit earlier. Well, here's the gist of it. There's apple or cherry wood. This is going to be sweet, you know, give it a sweeter flavor, and it's going to be great for pork or poultry. There's hickory, strong, classic. It's going to be great for ribs or pork shoulder. Oak, it's going to be more balanced. It kind of works with just about anything. And then there's mesquite, which is apparently more intense. Most people that I ran into say use it sparingly or blend it with some of the other ones. Now, all right, if you're curious about the process, and I was, I needed to know what the process is going to look like. When I hear that it can take hours, I need to know what exactly that looks like. Does it mean I'm glued to the smoker in the backyard for hours and hours on end? How am I going to pass my time? Or do I get to wander around and do other things and just pop in, pop out? You know, do I get to do it that way? Well, if that's you, if you need to understand how it's going to look like or what it's going to look like before you jump in, I've got a simplified version of the process, and it's really taken from the perspective of smoking chicken thighs. You know, different meats are going to take, you know, have different requirements for what you need to do, and it'll take different amounts of time. But this will still give you an idea of what the whole process looks like. All right, so first step, you need to set up your smoker for indirect heat. So get your charcoal going on one side of the firebox, put a water pan on the other side to kind of help regulate temperature and moisture. Then you're going to preheat the thing to around 250 degrees. You know, that's your target cooking temp. So you'll add wood chunks, you know, applewood, cherry, hickory, whatever you choose. And you do that after you got those coals ready. All right, so while that's heating up and getting ready, you're going to prep the chicken or whatever meat, but in this instance, it's the chicken. So you're going to pat the thighs dry, you're going to season them with your favorite rub, and then you're going to let them sit as that smoker stabilizes and gets to temperature. Once that's set, you're going to smoke everything on low, and you're going to smoke it slowly. So put them on the cool side of the smoker, skin side up, let them cook for about 1.5 to 2.5 hours. You know, until the internal temperature of the chicken thigh reaches 180 to 185 degrees. So you let that go for an hour and a half to 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. And what you're doing in that time frame is you're watching your phone to see, you know, if you've got the digital thermometer that reports to your phone, you know, with Bluetooth. You're checking the temperature, the internal temperature of the chicken thighs, and you're making sure that the temperature in the cooker stays right around 250 degrees. So you might need to pop in and add some coals, add wood a little bit to just keep things moving. You don't need to be glued to the thing. You get to wander around and do other things and just keep popping in and out. All right. After the 2.5 hours, 3 hours, when it reaches that 180 to 185 internal temperature on the chicken, basically you open it up and check it out. If the skin isn't crisp yet, and if you want it to be, this is optional, you can finish them over the hot coals for a minute or two per side just to get them a little crispier, all right? Then you need to let them rest for 5 to 10 minutes. And that resting thing, we're going to talk about that in a little bit. You let them rest, and then you dig in. And that's it. 2.5, 3 hours. Your first smoke is done. You're not doing a 12-hour brisket. You know, that's a little bit much for this first try. Try something simple. It's no stress. It's going to be good. So that's the chicken thighs. That's what the process looks like. Now, after digging into everything, you know, I've come away with a few things that kind of surprised me or intimidated me a little bit, sometimes a mixture of both. First off, you probably picked up on it already, but temperature management is everything. And charcoal smokers specifically take more attention than electric or pellet smokers. So that's something I'm going to have to work on and pay attention to as I'm going. I can't just be distracted and let this thing go. I've got to be on it. And that's a little intimidating. I can pull it off, but it is a little intimidating as I go in. Second, you need to let the meat rest after smoking it. And I mentioned this earlier. I'm going to explain it just a little bit here because it's important. And I'd never heard that concept before until I dug into this. You know, I was all about me resting, but I didn't know that the smoked meat needed to rest. But it's very important. If you skip the step, it's going to be a problem or you're going to affect the flavor. So in smoking meat, resting refers to the time or the period after the meat is done cooking, but before it's sliced or served. It's crucial. Here's why. First off, when the meat cooks, all the juices get pushed towards the outer edges. When you rest it before serving it, those juices have time to move back toward the center. So they don't all spill out when you cut into it. So you're not getting this dry piece of leather that you're serving. The juices will redistribute. The texture improves. It's another thing that resting does. It helps the meat firm up a little bit, makes it easier to slice, and gives you a better final texture. Also, the temperature stabilizes. That internal temperature usually rises a few degrees during the first part of the rest, and then it starts to cool after that. This helps finish the cooking process gently. All right, so that's something else I wasn't aware of. A little intimidating. I've got to get that figured out. There's a lot of different ways or times to let the meat rest depending on the meat that you're smoking. So look into that, and there's different ways to do it. Sometimes you just leave them out. Sometimes you wrap them in something. Sometimes you build a little. You're going to need to just look into it specifically for the meat that you're smoking. So dig into that. Don't forget about the resting. All right, another thing that was intimidating is that a lot of people who really get into this keep a notebook. You know, they log what they cooked, what wood they used, what temperature they hit, how long it took, and that helps them dial in their process over time. And why is that intimidating? It's intimidating because there's that much going on. There's so many variables at play in order to get to a good result. You know, these people who do it all the time have all these notes that they've compiled. Feels like we're building some sort of huge scientific device here. You know, that's intimidating. I can pull it off, but man, there's a lot going on. Finally, lots of people that I know who do this. This is my favorite part. Lots of people that I know who do this talk about their failures. You know, they talk about their successes too, of course, but they're not shy about the failures. You know, failure or less than stellar results. That's all part of the process. You know, it's part of learning the skill. You know, and I like that. That's a pleasant surprise to find out that failure is always an option because when you're me, failure is always in the cards. You never know when it's going to come up. All right, that's a quick overview, very, very brief. A lot more to the process than the hobby, but it's a quick look that maybe whets your appetite. You know, if you're looking for a new hobby and you like to eat, well, who knows? Maybe this is your next big thing. All right, that's smokers. Let's shift gears now pretty dramatically. Have you ever wondered why your carefully chosen paint color just looks off, just doesn't look right in your living room? That's next, right after this. You're listening to Home in Progress, real projects, real life, and a little bit of paint on your hands, in your eyes, in your hair, on your shirt, everywhere. Home in Progress is sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore, offering expert advice, premium paint, and all the tools you need to keep your home moving forward. All right, I've talked about it a ton of times here before, but it's worth repeating because it's so key to this conversation that we're going to have. Light, especially natural light, has a huge impact on how paint colors appear on your walls. Now, that's pretty obvious, I think, to most people. That's not one of those statements that people gasp about. You're kidding me. That's true? Yes, it's true. We get that. A lot of us get that. But what's not quite as obvious, and definitely not as easy to pin down, is this. The direction that a room faces, the way that it's exposed to sunlight and that natural light, that can dramatically affect the quality of light in that space. And that, in turn, has a huge influence on how any given color is going to actually look in a space. So over the next few weeks, we're going to break it down one direction at a time and talk through the quirks and considerations that come with each one. Today, we're starting with north-facing rooms. Now, these spaces get light that's cool and steady throughout the day. And while that sounds really good, it often results in a room that kind of feels a little bit flat, you know, a little bit chilly, depending on the color that you've chosen. The good news here is that you can absolutely counteract that vibe if you choose your colors intentionally. So let's dig into what works and why in a north-facing space. Now, first things first, let's understand the challenge that we're dealing with. North-facing rooms, they get light from the sky, not direct sunlight. And that means the light is cooler. It often dips into, you know, blue-gray tones, and it's steady, like I said, throughout the day. So paint colors don't shift dramatically with the sun when they're in north-facing rooms. That lack of warm sunshine can make even mid-tone paint chips look like dull grays or overly blue. Designers often are warning bright whites and cool tones are going to look stark or lifeless, or at least can, especially if you're trying to force a bright, sunny feel in a room that naturally feels dim and cool. So if you want to make a north-facing room feel cozy and inviting, you need to select colors with warm undertones, yellows, peachy neutrals, earthy greens, light beiges, colors like that. These are going to counterbalance that cool light instead of fighting it. So if you're looking for soft whites in your north-facing room, try colors like Benjamin Moore's Cotton Balls, White Chocolate, or Timid White. All of these offer a little bit of warmth and are going to make that space feel inviting. If you're looking for neutrals, you know, maybe that's your thing, try colors like Benjamin Moore's Elephant Tusk or Wheeling Neutral, or maybe greiges like Tapestry Beige or Lennox Tan. These are going to feel more grounded and, you know, more welcoming. They're going to feel more welcoming under north light. If you're looking for depth with your colors, you know, more than what I've talked about, Northlight supports it beautifully. You can pull it off. Just try deeper blues or greens, but always those that have a little bit of a yellow undertone. You know, so deep teal or moss green, not cool navy or something like that. If you really want to infuse the space with a little sunshine, you know, really try to warm it up. Peachy pinks, creamy yellows, warm apricot tones, colors like Weston Flax, Head Over Heels, and Satchel, all Benjamin Moore colors. They're going to bring a bit of a glow that combats that natural coolness. Now, I know I just reeled off a boatload of colors really quickly. And the good news is I've got all of this information in the show notes if you want to revisit it. Just go to repcolite.com, click the On the Radio tab on the homepage, and you can find the most current episode. And all of the colors that I just listed are in the show notes right there. All right. As you narrow down your color choices, don't forget that there's nothing better than wet sampling the colors in your space. We sell Benjamin Moore color samples for $5.99 each, and they give you enough paint to roll out a section on your wall or onto a poster board or something like that, so you can see the color in your space in your lighting at different times of the day. It's definitely worth the time and the effort to make sure that you're picking a color that you're going to love. So wrapping it all up, north-facing rooms don't need to feel cold or uninspired. There are colors out there that are going to work in those spaces to get to the tone or the atmosphere that you want to create. I just gave you a bunch of them to start with, to explore and work out. Make sure you sample them. And also, if you're running stuck, just swing into any Repcolite Paints location near you and talk to the people there. Bring pictures of your space, let us know what you're working on, and we'll help you find colors that get to exactly where you want to be. All right, next week we're going to look at south-facing rooms and the challenges associated with those. Now, next up, we're going to be looking at the high temps that are out there, high temperatures. We're looking at you, and we're going to talk about how you can successfully paint outside even when the temperatures are pushing to the levels that they have been. All of that's coming up after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repcolite Paints and Benjamin Moore. Top-tier paint, expert advice. Your next project is way easier than you think it's going to be. Well, I'm sure that I don't need to tell you it's been hot, right? I mean, we're all talking about it. It's all people are talking about. You're all experiencing it. The other day, I leaned against something. I don't even remember what. You know, I'd been outside, leaned against something, and I almost needed five people in the jaws of life to get me unstuck from it. I stuck to the surface that I leaned against. My shirt was stuck. I was stuck. I'm a soggy mess the whole time. This whole week, I'm wrinkled because I've been so soggy this whole time. And I know you don't need to know that, but my studio, you know, just let me take a quick aside here. My studio where I record, where I'm recording right now, there's no air. I mean, there's air. I'm breathing air. There's no air conditioning. It's a brick building, so it's like an oven once it heats up. Oh, it retains that heat, let me tell you. I walked in the other day. I've been getting here so early, you know, because I keep thinking I'll get there early before it really heats up. Well, I got here the other day at 6:30 or so and walked in, checked the thermostat, and it's 86 degrees at 6:30 in the morning. And it's only going up from there because there's no way to cool it down. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's absolutely pleasant. Right? Wonderfully pleasant. And I know we're hearing people say things like, and these are do-gooders, you know, optimists. I don't know. Maybe they're just, you know, they just want to rankle us. But they're saying things like, well, you know, in a few months, we're going to be wishing we had this weather. Right? Right? Really? A few months is September. Do the math. And first off, if the past few years are any indication, we will have this weather then. Right? It's going to be miserable in September, too. It always seems to be. And even if we don't, if we do have like blessed 70-degree weather, if it's literally really fall in September/October, I'm certainly not going to be wishing for the withering heat to return. Boy, I'd sure like to be outside wishing I could take off even more clothes so I could survive. No, I'm going to be appreciating sweatshirt weather. I am not going to be wishing for the withering heat. And then you've got the other people who think about it a little deeper, and they say things like, well, when winter comes, and we've got our Michigan snow, you're going to be wishing for this heat, right? So enjoy it. Well, still, I'd personally, you know, rather have the cold. And I kind of hinted at it already. I can bundle up. I can layer clothing. You know, I can put on coats. I can put on a sweatshirt. I can put on long underpants. I can do all kinds of things. But in the summer, in the heat, there's only so much that you can take off before certain, you know, lines are crossed, you know, before the police have to get involved, before a lot of things happen, before you end up on the news. So anyway, I know everybody means well, and there isn't much use in complaining. I'm not trying to complain. We can't change the weather. This is what we've got. So let's just make the most of it, right? In the midst of this scorching, humid stretch, a lot of questions come up about exterior painting. You know, I've been handling a fair amount of those. People are wondering, what are the ramifications of painting in the heat? Is it even possible? Can we do it? Or do we have to wait for this fall or next spring sometime? Well, if you have projects still coming up this summer that you'd like to get to, exterior projects, good news is you absolutely can do it. You just need to understand what heat does to paint and how to work around all of that. So first off, let's talk about what extreme heat and humidity actually do to the paint that you're applying. Now, when you look at, you know, Benjamin Moore, go to their website, do a little research. Benjamin Moore is going to note that most of its products have an optimal application temperature, and that range is usually between 35 degrees Fahrenheit and 100 degrees Fahrenheit, preferably with low humidity. Now, admittedly, that's a crazy broad range, right? 35 degrees to 100 degrees. So it kind of feels like it's a green light to paint. You know, if you're not frozen outside, you're not freezing, and if your skin's not bubbling off as you stand outside, you can paint. You know, you're within the range. But there are some caveats that you need to think about and be aware of. And first off, it's this. Regardless of that sweeping generalization, you know, the 35 degrees to 100 degrees, regardless of that, regardless of the fact that Benjamin Moore says that's the general range, you need to always consult the can label or the technical data sheet on the product that you're using. You know, not all products are made the same. And just because one product from a given brand works in certain temperatures, that doesn't mean that they're all going to be the best for those situations. So check the label every time. It's just a good safety step to make sure that the product you're using is suitable for the situation you're in. And that applies to heat, but it also applies to low temperatures as well. There is going to be some differences around there, so definitely dig into that before you just jump in. Secondly, don't forget that the temperature range that they're giving, the one that you're reading on the can's label or on the tech data sheets, remember that that range includes surface temperature, not just air temperature. You know, a surface that's been sitting in the direct sun can be way hotter than the air temperature. Even as that surface transitions into shade, it can retain that heat for quite a while. So you could have air temps that are right in the range, but that surface temp could be, you know, 10, 15, 20 degrees above the range yet just because it's been sitting in the sun. So keep that in mind when you're determining whether or not you can start painting. Now, why does it matter? Why can't you paint on a surface that exceeds the recommended temperature range? Well, if you do, it can lead to a lot of different problems that can be really tough to fix down the road. For example, the heat can cause the paint to bubble and blister as it dries. That's going to compromise the paint film's integrity. You know, that's bad. You don't want that. The surface can be so hot that it causes the paint to dry really quickly, and that can make it difficult to blend the edges together as you're working. You know, you're rolling, and you come back with the next row or whatever you want to call it, the next swatch of paint that you're rolling on, and that first one that you rolled just minutes before can already be starting to dry if that surface is too hot. And rather than having a wet edge that you can blend right together with the new paint that you're rolling on, you end up with dried areas, and it makes it very tough to blend these things together. You end up with lap marks, and it's really a pain in the neck to try to fix down the road. Not an easy fix at all once that starts happening. So you don't want that, all right? Also, the paint may dry unevenly, and that can lead to a finish that's not smooth and consistent. So shiny spots, flat spots, dull spots, you know, it just doesn't look nice. That can happen. The quick drying can also lead to poor adhesion, and of course, that's going to shorten the lifespan of the paint job. There are more things that could go wrong, but really, those should be enough to make you want to do it right. So how do you do that? How do you do it right? The simple answer is to do what the professional painters do and chase the shade. You know, start early in the morning before the surface heats up, when the dew has burned off at least, but early enough before it really heats up. And then as the day progresses, just as much as you can, work your way around the home, staying in the shade as much as possible. If you want to be extra safe as you work, Before you even jump into it, go ahead and pick up an infrared thermometer. You know, these things look like radar guns. You can measure the surface temp just by pointing at it and then clicking the trigger. They're cheap, crazy cheap, really, for what you're probably thinking. I think you can find them for $30. You can find expensive ones, but you can find one that will be adequate for $30 or so. And you can scan the surface temperature easily. You know, from wherever you're sitting, from a place of comfort, you can scan that surface temperature before you even get up to go out and start gathering your tools, and you can decide if it's good enough for painting or not. So do that. If it's within the range, you know, the recommended range for your product, then go for it. If it's not, if it's too hot, don't start. All right, another thing, and this one's obvious, but don't forget that the heat isn't just tough on your paint. It can put a strain on you as well, right? And not just make you bitter and grumpy, but it's not good for you. You know, it can actually be unhealthy. And it can be unhealthy or dangerous or concerning for your painter if you're hiring the work done. So make sure you're drinking lots of water. Use sun protection, wear breathable clothing, take regular cool down breaks, all of that stuff. And when you take a break, here's a quick tip. Place your tools, of course, in the shade. You know, put your roller tray and your roller in there and lay your brush in there. Put that all in the shade and then drape a damp cloth over the tray or the bucket or whatever you're working out of. And that's going to prevent it from skinning up as it dries or getting crusty. And it's also going to keep bugs and leaves and other debris out of your paint. So that's a really good way to go. Remember that. Also, if you've hired a contractor to do the work and you're not the one out there doing it, you're in the comforts of air conditioning, watching them work. If that's your situation, I can guarantee you that you will be a rock star among people if you take some steps to provide your painters with a shady area to take their breaks, you know, whether that's umbrellas, whatever you've got, you know, patio umbrellas, stuff like that. If you've got big trees, great. Maybe keep cold waters in the fridge, break them out from time to time. Nobody's going to say no to that. Gatorades that are cold, that would be wonderful. They'd love it. If possible, even offer them, you know, the use of an indoor space with air conditioning if, you know, like I said, if that's possible in your situation. Last thing is to be sure that you pick products that are designed to function in weather like you're working in. You know, if it's colder or if it's hot, make sure that you're getting products that are designed for that. The best product that you can afford that's designed for that. You know, buying cheap or inferior paint just isn't worth it. Putting the paint on, you know, think about it this way, putting the paint on to that surface, that exterior, if, you know, that's what you're doing, that's what we're talking about. So let's say you're painting your house. Putting the paint on takes the same amount of work, whether it's quality paint that's going to last and last, or whether it's cheap paint that's going to fade and struggle quickly. It's not worth trying to save a few bucks or even a couple $100 only to end up with paint that doesn't last beyond a few years. You're going to spend a lot more time and money trying to fix a cheap paint that failed than you would have just by spending the money on the good stuff right off the bat. Paint isn't all equal. And I know it seems like there's not a lot to a gallon of paint and that they all seem kind of the same when you look at them in the can, but there's a reason. You know, there really is a reason that there's an $80 price tag on one and a $25 price tag on another. It's not just the brand, you know, it's not just hype or something like that. The better paint is made with better ingredients, better technology. And that means it's going to apply better, it's going to last longer, it's going to hold its color better, and all of that stuff. So get the good stuff. It's not worth skimping. And when it comes to the good stuff, Aura Exterior and Regal Select High Build, both of those are great. They're going to offer superior UV resistance, flexibility, a great adhesion on a variety of different surfaces. You can't go wrong with them. They're from Benjamin Moore. Repcolite's Endura, another great exterior product. Definitely something to think about. And then there's Benjamin Moore's Element Guard. Now, Element Guard's a newer product, and it will work in cold temperatures as well as extreme heat. But its main claim to fame is that it's rain-ready in a single hour, which means if you paint with Element Guard and then we get a pop-up shower, you know, just an hour after you painted, the paint film is going to be unaffected. Even a driving rain won't hurt Element Guard after just an hour. Now, my son, he is working, this is his second year, he's working on a crew, painting crew, doing exteriors, and they were working last week in Grand Rapids. And he came home, and he told me about an unexpected rain shower that came out of the blue, you know, caught them all by surprise. And it was literally like a Benjamin Moore commercial because the crew leader told everybody as they're waiting out the rain that they were fine, not to worry about it, because they were using Element Guard. it was kind of fun to hear. You know, they were all worried because they just accomplished a lot of areas that they painted that they did not want to have to get the ladders out and do again. So they were asking, are we going to have to redo everything? And the guy said, hey, don't worry about it. It's Element Guard. You're good to go. So that's really fun to hear. There are a lot of marketing claims that get made by paint companies, and often they're stretching the truth. Element Guard, that's the real deal, and it can really save your project. On top of that, Element Guard's going to be on sale all July long, so I should get that in here before we wrap this up. We're not exactly there yet. It's not July yet, and I am jumping the gun a little bit. But if you do come into Repcolite starting July 1, you can get Element Guard for about $45 to $50 per gallon, depending on the finish that you pick. You're basically going to save $20 for every gallon. The sale is going to run all July long. Now, it's not going yet. I've said that, said it a couple times, but it's going to start next Tuesday. Heavy summer heat and humidity don't have to doom your exterior paint job, but they do demand smarter planning. With the right products, the right schedule, a little bit of patience, you can keep your home looking great all summer long. Now, if you've got an exterior paint project on the horizon, stop out at Repcolite and let us help. All right, we're hitting the last segment here, and I'm sure everybody out there is sitting on the edge of their seat waiting with bated breath for the conversation about clotheslines. Well, the good news is it's coming up right after this. And the better news is that it's really worth the wait. This is Home in Progress, where the to-do list is long, and that's all right. We're not crabbing at you. We're not going to yell at you. That's how it is. It's how ours is, too. It's proudly supported by Repcolite Paints and Benjamin Moore, because home projects are easier when you've got people you can trust. Well, I've got loads, boatloads of great memories from my childhood, you know, a ton of them. But one of them that really hits hard is kind of weird. It's the clothes on the line in our backyard. You know, it was always Mom's thing. We had a pool, and we spent most of the summer in the pool. And I remember swimming around and seeing Mom pinning clothes on the line, you know, doing all the work while we're all hanging out in the pool and kicking around and laughing and having fun. Not Dad. Dad was at work. Except on the weekends, then Dad joined us and left Mom putting clothes on the line. But after swimming, I remember running to the clothesline and then yanking off a warm towel. I love that. I remember the sound of sheets flapping, you know, on the line in the breeze. I sometimes made tents out of the sheets, and that could get me in trouble if I wasn't careful and if I got them dirty. But it was worth it. It was a ton of fun. And it wasn't just Mom doing it. You know, everywhere we drove when I was growing up, there were houses with clothes out on the line. I remember pulling into Grandma's driveway at her old farmhouse and seeing three or four lines full of laundry, you know, hanging there. Great big underpants flapping in the breeze. You know, sometimes Grandma was out there with the laundry basket waving at us. Those were really good memories. Pure nostalgia. You know, the nostalgia is pure with that one. Anyway, hanging clothes on the line. For a lot of us, that's something that we haven't done in ages, you know, if we've ever done it. Maybe our parents did it. Maybe our grandparents did it. Maybe the neighbors all did it. But are you taking advantage of this crazy old technology, this grandma tech, to dry your clothes? Maybe you should be. And I think when we're all done talking, I'm going to have converted a lot of you. So if you're thinking that there's no way you're going to get interested, let's just find out, all right? And it's not just about saving a few bucks on your electric bill, although that is part of it. You know, so that's a big part of it. A little part of it. Let's not say it's a big part of it. Here are a bunch of different reasons why it's worth thinking about. First off, your clothes are going to last longer when you hang them out to dry. You know, every time you run a dryer, you're breaking down the fibers in your clothing. You know, all that fuzz, I've never thought about this because I'm a complete moron sometimes, but all that fuzz in the lint trap, what is that? That's not extra stuff that you're just finding. That's your shirts, that's your socks, that's your underpants and towels all slowly wearing away. You know, heat and friction can be really rough on fabrics. Line drying avoids both of those things. And your clothes, your bedding, your towels, your underpants are going to look better and last longer because of it. So there's one big benefit right off the bat. Another one, you're going to have fewer wrinkles to deal with. You know, how many times have you pulled a wrinkled mess out of the dryer because you forgot about it? You know, out of sight, out of mind. And then you get it out, you look at it, and it leads to another cycle in the dryer. If you're us, or it could lead, God forbid, it could lead to ironing, which is just, that is an art I don't think I'm ever going to master or understand or even get adequate at. So I normally throw everything back into the dryer and run it for another round. But shirts, pants, and sheets and all of that hung out on the line to dry, they come in almost wrinkle-free. So that's a huge win. Huge win. There's also the energy savings. All right, appliances, they account for, you know, something like 13 to 14% of your household energy use. And the dryer is one of the biggest offenders. You know, it's just sitting there, sucking up energy and running up bills. This past Saturday, this is why this is all in my head anyway. This is why we're talking about it this week, is because of last Saturday, I washed a ton of blankets. It took me all day long to move them through the washer and the dryer. And all day long, the dryer ran, burning up money. And as it was going, and as I'm doing that, I kept wishing that I had clotheslines in place so I could use them. Now, if you like the idea of saving energy, saving a little bit of money, keep in mind that during the spring, summer, and fall, the sun is a free and incredibly effective dryer. Even on partly sunny days, you know, breezy days, it's going to get the job done. So think about that. Another one, the convenience of line, you know, drying clothes on the line might surprise you. You know, you might think it's going to be inconvenient because it's old tech. You know, the dryer is more convenient. Well, large items, sheets, blankets, towels, they're easier to fold after they've been on the line drying because they're not twisted or bundled up like they are when they come out of a dryer. And more importantly, you can often hang more at once than your dryer can handle. That's what I was thinking with all the blankets that I was trying to dry. I was drying them one at a time. I could have filled my lineup with blankets. The washer wasn't the thing slowing me down. It was the dryer. If I could have gotten those blankets out onto the line, I'd have been golden. So with the right setup out there, you can actually move through your laundry day faster by using the clothesline to dry your stuff. All right, another overlooked benefit. Dryers heat up your house, even vented dryers. Depending on the cycle, a dryer can emit temperatures over 120 degrees. Now, that's okay in February. Maybe it's even good to some extent. But in July, it's just making your air conditioner work harder and harder and harder. It's driving up your cooling costs. And even more important, it's making us sweat more, right? Hotter house, you're sweating more. And what happens when you sweat more? Well, you're putting it all into your clothing. And when your clothing is full of sweat, you got to wash it more often. And then when you wash it, remember what happens? The heat and the friction, they're beating it up. So we're actually tearing our clothes apart. It's a vicious cycle. If you just get them outside on the line, all of that stops. Some of that stops. I'm being a little dramatic there, but I think you get the point. Line drying, another benefit, reduces your risk of dryer fires, right? Because you're not running the dryer as much. Dryers are one of the more common sources of household fires. It's caused by the lint building up, and we just don't get that out, you know, and not just from the lint trap, but from the ducts themselves. Hanging your clothes out on the line, it's going to cut the risk down dramatically. It's just one less thing to worry about. And don't forget about this last one that I've got, last benefit of drying the clothes on the line, the sun is a natural disinfectant and deodorizer. Ultraviolet light, it kills odor-causing bacteria, mold spores, even some viruses. And it's not just hype. Sunlight really does, you know, remove smells, eliminate smells that your dryer can't. Some musty towels, sweat-soaked gym shorts, or shirts, I guess. I didn't need to say shorts. That made it grosser than it needed to be. Stubborn organic stains, things like that. Sunlight gives you, you know, a natural chemical-free boost at getting those smells out and stains out and all of that. And combining it with the fresh air, it's going to help all of the things that cause bad smells to dissipate faster, you know, to just move away quicker. So bottom line, dryers are going to mask odors with heat and softeners and all of that stuff. Sunlight is actually going to help eliminate them. Okay, so with all of those benefits, and that's a lot of good stuff, what's stopping us? Why aren't we all rushing out to the store right now to buy clotheslines and armfuls of clothespins and all of that? Well, real life is stopping us. You know, we're cynical. We've seen things. We've been around the block. We know that it's not all, you know, it's not all sunshine and daisies when it comes to clotheslines. There are bugs and birds, dusty days, and more. A lot of reasons why I might not want to put my clothes outside to dry. Well, the good news is, while there are a bunch of objections, there are a lot of answers to those objections. And let's just work our way through a few of them. And let's start with space. Not everybody has a big backyard, right? That's a pretty good objection. I don't have space for this. I don't have a spot where I can permanently set up poles and clotheslines, you know, in my yard. Well, that's actually not a problem. There are a lot of different options out there for small yards. Or if you literally don't have yard space, there are options that you can use indoors and still be hanging up your clothes to dry. So retractable clotheslines, that's one way that you could go. They'll mount to a wall or a fence or a post or whatever, then it pulls out, it's retractable. You know what that means. Pulls out, you snap it to another side, you can use it when you need it, and you just zip it back in place when it's not in use. So retractable clotheslines, that's one way to go. Umbrella or rotary drying racks, we've seen these. They're foldable, they're relatively compact. Some models, you can remove them from their base entirely. They'll spin, so you've got easy access to all sides. They can be installed on just a small patch of grass. They can be mounted in a weighted base. They can be easily moved around. That's another way to go. Wall-mounted folding racks. You know, they'll fold flat against the wall when not in use. They come in metal or wood options. They're great for your back porch, for your balcony, maybe a fence panel. On and on. Basically, don't write yourself out of the clothesline drying gig. There's a solution for every space. Okay. What about allergens? That's another big one. Hanging clothes outside can leave them coated in pollen, especially during peak allergy season, and that's going to make your freshly cleaned laundry, you know, kind of like a booby trap. You're going to be all puffy and sneezy and all of that just because you tried to follow my advice and hang your clothes on the line. How do you deal with that one? Well, to reduce the risk, try hanging your clothes out earlier in the morning, you know, before pollen levels start to climb. And you can also, by all means, we've all got phones with 8 million apps on them, and lots of those apps, at least half of them, seem to be weather apps. And on those weather apps, you can get your local pollen forecast, and you can aim for hanging your clothes out on lower count days. That's another way to go. If you're still concerned about it, you could dry indoors near an open window or with a fan to kind of mimic that fresh air feel. And if you've got a screened-in porch or a sunroom, that's kind of a great middle ground. You can get the fresh air moving through and still minimize the pollen. So I can't completely solve the allergen problem, but it can be minimized. All right, what about birds? Birds are a concern. You know, they wait for us to wash our cars, and then they do their thing on the clean cars. And you can bet if you put your clothes on the line, they're coming for them too, right? Well, not necessarily. Or if they do come for them, you can deter them. You can get them to go away. First off, and this is obvious, but people really do mess this up all the time. First up, move your bird feeders away from your clothes drying area. Don't bring the birds in with food and then be surprised when they stay to use the restroom. It's just natural. It's how they're going to do it. So move the bird feeders way far away from the clotheslines. Obvious, but just go check it out. People mess this up a lot. Second, hang shiny ribbons or old CDs or, you know, little Mylar strips. Mylar, I think that's the right word. The little shiny strips. I think I already said that. Shiny ribbons. Hang those on the lines. That'll be a visual deterrent. Birds don't like that. Plastic owls. That also works, and it looks crazy cool. I mean, you've got this huge bird of prey perched on your clothesline. Who doesn't think that's cool? It's kind of like you're a pirate. Well, not really a pirate because they had parrots. You know what I'm saying? It's just a cool look and it'll keep the birds away. You could try that. If you've got trees overhead, of course, trim them back so they're not overhanging your lines. And if you're installing clotheslines, make sure you're looking for spaces without trees nearby if you can do that. You know, don't think about that. That's a nice shady spot to be putting clothes on the line in the summer. Don't think about it that way. You'll regret that. You'll rue the day that you put them in the shady spot because the birds will teach you a lesson. All right, what about bugs? A few years back, I hung some damp towels on the line because we're not hanging dry towels on the line. That doesn't make any sense. So I put some damp towels on the line, and a few hours later, they're all good, and I brought them into the house, grabbed the first one out of the basket, shook it out as I'm getting ready to fold it, and suddenly I have sprayed the table, the nearby children, pretty much most of the kitchen, with about 20 or 30 crunchy little flying bugs that were all hidden in the towels. In seconds, the kitchen, the home, went from, you know, the usual to something that felt like a biblical plague was happening, you know? Bugs were buzzing everywhere. The children were screaming or hollering or doing whatever. Somebody had bugs in their yogurt, and they were upset about that. You just pick the bugs out, and you can keep going. It's yogurt. I mean, what can you do bad to yogurt that's not already been done to it? But anyway, You don't want that. Bugs are a real issue. They're drawn to dampness. They can be a real bummer if you bring them into your home. So hang your laundry on warm, breezy days to speed the drying along and reduce insect interest. And also, and of course, most importantly, shake the clothes out well before you bring them into the house. Find the bugs outside. You know, they may be there, but you can get them off outside. All right, what about the softness of the clothes coming in off the line? Aren't my towels going to be crunchy? That can happen, and we all love that soft, fluffy feel when it comes to towels. You know, nobody wants to be rubbing sandpaper-like things all over their face when they come out of the shower. Towels off the line really do have a tendency to sometimes feel stiff, and you can fix that by giving them a good shake before you hang them, giving them another good shake before you fold them. And when you're hanging them on the line, another thing you can do to help this is to increase the space between them so there's more airflow. Don't just stack them edge to edge to make the most of your space. Give them some room, some elbow room in between for airflow. That will help. You can add a half a cup of white vinegar to the rinse cycle in your washer. That's going to naturally soften the fabric without leaving a scent. So that's a way to go. And if you really want that extra fluff, you know, that extra softness, toss them in the dryer for maybe 5 minutes or so on no or low heat when you bring them in off the line. That will fluff them up and you'll be perfectly pleased with the process and you won't have used tons of energy with the dryer. Okay, that's dealing with some of the main obstacles out there. Let's talk gear, and then we'll wrap this up. And when it comes to gear, you got to start with the right clothesline. This is going to make all the difference when it comes to durability and ease of use. So look for a UV-resistant, low-stretch line because you want to avoid sagging over time. A great option is PVC-coated galvanized steel wire. It's going to resist rust. It's going to hold up to the sun and the rain in daily use. It's not going to sag. Shoot for a line that's probably about an eighth inch in diameter, thick enough to support wet towels without digging into your laundry. If you have great big expanses between the poles, if the line is covering a pretty big area, you're probably going to need to go to, you know, a thicker gauge diameter line in order to span that distance. But for a typical span, an eighth inch diameter line is going to be great. Don't go with those really cheap, you know, the plastic clotheslines. They're going to sag in a heartbeat. So go to the good stuff. Drop the money for the good stuff. It's not that expensive and it's going to pay off down the road. Also, get good clothespins. For long-lasting performance, look for heavy-duty wooden clothespins, you know, made from hardwoods like birch, like maple. If you want the most durable option, you know, you really want to go whole hog here, go with stainless steel clothespins. They're resistant to rust, to weather. They're not going to break. They're not going to crack. They're especially good at holding heavier items like towels or blankets on the line. If you do go with the stainless steel ones, look for pins with a wide grip and smooth edges so you avoid snagging delicate fabrics. Another thing, be sure to pick up a clothespin bag or bucket to keep everything handy. Just don't leave it outside overnight. You know, pins can mildew or rust over time if they're exposed to dew or rain. And the bag itself, you know, this is the biggest part of all of why you don't leave this outside overnight. The bag itself becomes this inviting home, you know, this beacon for all kinds of creepy crawly bugs that love damp, dark places. You know, the last thing I want to do is to be reaching my hand into that kind of spot. You know, it's like Indiana Jones or something like that. I don't want to do that when I'm hanging clothes on the line. Don't leave the little bag outside overnight. All right, last couple things, a couple of tips that people sometimes forget about. First off, check your sprinkler schedule. And don't overlap it with putting clothes on the line. You know, there's nothing worse than waking up to a freshly soaked line full of clean clothes, you know, because the sprinklers kicked on at 6 a.m. and you forgot to take them off the line last night. So keep that all in mind. Remember your sprinklers and work around them. These things can work in tandem, but they don't work well together. So don't leave clothes on the lines if you've got sprinklers going. Also, if you've got pets, keep that in mind. I know my dog, Fern, would really, really wreak some havoc if I had a bunch of clothes on the line that she could reach and she was not being supervised. So you know your pets, just keep them in mind. Pets and clothes on the line can coexist, but they can also, you know, pets can really wreak some havoc. So keep that in mind. Last thing I want to say before we wrap it up for the week is don't feel like you need to make some kind of major lifestyle change overnight when it comes to clothes on the line. You know, start with one load, you know, maybe just some towels or some bedding. Try it once. See how it feels. It's not going to be right for everybody. It's not the answer for everybody, but you might just enjoy the rhythm of it. You know, kind of slows things down in a good way, speeds things up in another. You can get a lot more on the line than you can cram into your dryer. The clothes smell fresher. Your dryer gets that break. It's going to last a little longer. Power bill maybe goes down a little bit. House stays a little cooler. You get to be outside a little more in these wonderful, wonderful 90 plus degree days. Who wouldn't want more of that? Anyway, think about it. Let me know your experiences. I'd love to hear from you. Radio@repcolite.com is the easiest way to get in touch with me. Yeah, send me your thoughts about anything that I covered in the show this week. All right, that's going to do it. Thanks for spending some time with us on Home in Progress. If your project's halfway done, you know, your garage is still a mess, it's calling your name, but you haven't gotten to it yet. Maybe the laundry is still out on the line, you just remembered. You left it out on the line overnight, and I just reminded you, and you're wondering about the sprinkler schedule and if it's soaking wet. If that's you, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. We're not going to yell at you. Remember, that's how the show works. We're all a work in progress. Our homes are all homes in progress. You're in good company. Now, if you enjoyed the episode this week, be sure to follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've got a minute, leave us a review. Helps other listeners find the show, and we'd really appreciate it. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repcolite Paints and Benjamin Moore, offering expert advice, premium paint, and all the tools you need to keep your projects moving forward. New episodes are going to drop every week, so we'll see you next time. And until then, keep chipping away at that list.